Now, this was a bit of a monster conversation because there was just so much to cover from Ben's fabulous essay. So, you're listening to part one, and this is going to cover Ben's role as the expedition base camp doctor on Everest, his kind of expedition background, and including the trek up to Everest and his experiences along the way. He'll also talk a little bit about his experience with the Sherpa people and Buddhism whilst on the Everest Base Camp trek, and how that was really important to the kind of culture around the mountain of Everest. In part two, we're going to be looking at some of the logistics of the mountain and how this is heavily supported by the Sherpas and the porters, and how it just wouldn't be possible without them. Some of the medicine on the mountain, so some of the cases that Ben experienced, both common illnesses and some of the more interesting cases that he came across, including some of the challenging and very difficult decisions he had to make. We then finish by thinking about some of the politics of the mountain, some of the major challenges of Everest and the rapid commercialization of the mountain and the region, and what the future might hold in terms of trekking to Everest and trekking up Everest, and how things might need to change in the future in order to make this sustainable and to prevent future deaths on the mountain. We'll finish off with a conclusion, final thoughts, and there's no better way to finish than to hear from the horse's mouth. Ben will read out his conclusion from his openly, publicly available essay, and we'll just acknowledge the people who did sadly die on Everest this year. So, welcome to the podcast. I'm really excited to share this one with you guys. We get a lot of good detail, a lot of good topics to talk about in this one. So let's dive straight in. Hello, and welcome to the World Extreme Medicine podcast. If you're into medicine in cooler places or looking to get high on inspiration, pun intended, then you're in the right place. I'm your host for today, Dr. Fionn Davis, emergency medicine and expedition doctor. Our guest today is Dr. Benjamin Alba, who I was actually in the same year at medical school with. So since med school, Ben has gone on to be the doctor for an Everest Base Camp trek and has just finished a season as one of the Everest Base Camp doctors. Following his experiences at Everest Base Camp, he was inspired to write an open essay entitled Everest 2023, The Season of Death, highlighting some of the misconceptions and challenges on Everest. At the end of the season, there had been 12 confirmed deaths, with five missing, assumed dead, taking the tally to 17 people this year on Everest. Since the 2010 season, 114 people have been killed on Everest, and the average number of deaths per season is eight. So this season was considerably higher. Bar the avalanche of 2014, which killed 15 people, and the earthquake of 2015, which killed 20 people, it makes this season the worst season on record for deaths on Everest without a natural disaster. But on a lighter note, welcome to the podcast, Ben.
Thanks. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Thank you so much for joining us. I know you fit us into your busy schedule. Just come back from Kilimanjaro trip and just about to move to Cornwall.
Yeah, that's right. I'm just heading down there for an ED job and yeah, looking forward to it. Bit of surfing, bit relaxing, nice weather, hopefully. We'll
Sounds
see how it
ideal.
goes.
Yeah. So, do you want to just tell us a little bit about your role at Everest Base Camp and like maybe how you got to that job and your sort of background in expedition?
Yeah, sure. So, as a bit of a background, so I went to Cardiff University and then graduated in 2018. I did my F1 F2 in West Wales in Haf West and then Cardiff, and kind of got a lot of ED experience in that time. So I ended up doing 8 months of ED in F2 because of COVID, and I did 4 months in F1 as well, and got involved with the RNLI and then did some kind of casualty evacuation training with them, and then also did some ultra races in the UK with a company based in Bristol. So I kind of got a bit of a taste for doing races and kind of being involved with the outdoors as well as the medical side of things. But I was kind of struggling to kind of push to the next step, which was obviously going abroad with it and going on expeditions. So during F3, when I was in ITU, I just decided to do a diploma in expedition wilderness medicine. And that kind of really helped to open the door, both for my understanding and just kind of learning about what was involved in that. So altitude medicine, diet medicine, jungle and wilderness medicine. But also just kind of meeting people and kind of networking. And then through that, I managed to get the base camp kind of trek job last year, which I went on with the company. And then I kind of had my, I don't know, it kind of stimulated my juices for wanting to find out more about Everest. So I wanted to go there this year. And then when I was working in New Zealand, I basically got in touch with someone who I knew would have a doctor at the camp. And I said, look, I'm looking for a job. I know you guys haven't been active for a few years, and I was wondering if I could kind of get involved. And they said yes.
Yeah, it never hurts to ask, right? You never know when somebody's going to say yes.
Exactly.
So as part of the Everest Base Camp trek, most companies will fly into Lukla Airport, which I've heard is pretty terrifying, and one of the most dangerous airports in the world. So before we sort of go on the trek up to base camp, what was the airport like? What was that experience like?
So thankfully this year I flew in on a helicopter, and last year flew in by plane. The plane is quite something when you've got kind of a 15-seater, 20-seater plane. The lady comes up the front with her little card to tell you about the emergency exit, and she's bending her head because she's taller than the cabin itself, and then she closes the back door and you can still see air around the side, so it's not a depressurized cabin. So that was all kind of a bit sketchy. And then you finally come into Lukla Airport, and it's 520 meters long runway, and it's on a 12 degree slope on a mountainside. So you're kind of flying at the wall as if you're going to hit it, and at the last moment they kind of pull up and land on this runway. So yeah, it's quite exciting. You can find it on YouTube if you type in like Lukla Airport landing. It's quite interesting. And unfortunately, the plane I was on last year actually crashed 2 weeks later and everyone died on it. So they do have their problems out there. And it's a bit
sketchy. I remember hearing about that.
Yeah. So it can be a bit dangerous, but I think the helicopter's a bit more safe. And it was quite exciting to fly by helicopter this year, mainly because you get to a bit of a better view. So we could kind of see all over the valley as we were coming in, and kind of looking down at the farmlands and kind of looking at the villages as we were coming in, which was, it was really cool, actually.
Yeah, I bet you had some amazing views of the mountains and the valley that
you could walk. Certainly did, the range as we came, we came east and you could look north, and it was just lands for ages. It was really cool. Yeah.
Love that. Always, like you said, gets the juices flowing, see the mountains, and you're like, yep, I'm ready.
Exactly.
So you, in your essay that you've published, you give a really good descriptive account of your trek up to base camp. But can you maybe just describe a little bit of your kind of experiences on the trek up to base camp, some of your favourite bits?
Yeah, so the trek is really, really beautiful, and I'd recommend anyone who wants to go to that area does that trek, or goes to kind of Annapurna Circuit. I've heard that's really nice as well. So you land in Lukla, and you kind of amble out of the airport and wander on the paved slabs, and there's kind of tea houses to either side, which are these kind of concrete block houses with sort of like wooden kind of cantilevers and things, and there's lots of things for sale, like little maps and Coca-Cola and Sprite and those kind of things, Snickers bars that are out of date and all that kind of stuff, and then it kind of just disappears, the end of the town just ends, and you get into this dusty trail then that's the kind of trail then you follow all the way up to base camp, which is kind of a good 12-day walk kind of all the way up into the valley, which is really amazing. And every day there's different views. So you follow the banks of the Dukosi, which is the big river. And then you cross some pretty rickety bridges, which are like one person wide. And they're hanging over these like really kind of aggravated waters, which is quite cool. And then you pass through farming villages. There's lots of communities there, obviously up the river, that are kind of based themselves around the river and the land as well. So think of farms. The main farming out there is potatoes and kind of root vegetables. And you can kind of, you just walk past their farms. So you've got little dry stone walls, and you just look over and there's yaks being herded and things. So that's really cool. Just kind of, if you feel like you're right in the middle of the community, really, as you're traveling up. And then you stay in the tea houses themselves. And like I said, they're just concrete houses with rooms. And then in the living area, the dining area, there's like a bigger room that's got kind of a fireplace in the middle, which has, so it's a yak dung fire most often than not. So they dry yak dung into like kind of patties, and then they just like chuck them in the fire, and quite smoky. But it really gets the room quite warm when there's 50 people in there all sweating from a big long day of walking. So that's really cool as well. And your room's a bit colder than the living room, so you need a good sleeping bag. But yeah, it's quite comfy really when you're going up the valley. And then as you're doing that, you go through these towns and along these walls, and there's lots of history there and a lot of culture as well. So obviously the Sherpa people are very deeply Buddhist. So although Nepal is mainly Hindu, the Sherpa themselves are Buddhist, and there's lots of things on the way. So there's prayer, there's lots of prayer flags hanging over the route as you're walking along, which are these just like banners, essentially lots of multicolored banners. Then you've got mani stones and mani walls, and these are basically either stones or big rocks that have been chiseled in Sanskrit with a phrase called O Mani Padme Hum, which is like their like chanting, kind of tantric chanting that they do. And that's kind of, they're painted black and white, and they're very kind of like, they just stand out quite well. And then you've got the prayer wheels as well. So there's just random rows of prayer wheels that you can walk along and kind of stroke as you go past too. And then there's dogs everywhere, which is kind of cute. So there's just stray dogs all on the route, which is all the way up to 5,500 meters, actually. I think the highest I saw a dog was 5,800 meters. So they're pretty well out to being up there.
Wow.
Yeah, but they're kind of cute, and you just get to see them all the way up. And the yaks are, yeah, the yaks are cool. There's lots of yak trains carrying stuff. And then there's porters and Sherpa everywhere as well. So that's really cool to engage with them and just like speak to them about kind of what's going on in the area and stuff. So yeah, it's a really, really magical walk that changes every day. And you've got these amazing views of mountains, and a lot of cultural things all around you as well, which is really cool.
Yeah, it sounds it. So you've got like a good balance of kind of beautiful views, interesting walking, and then also the kind of cultural aspects along the way of staying in the tea houses and chatting to
100%. And I think the cultural thing is really what drew me back, really. Like that kind of, I understand the people and really engage with them. And yeah, that was kind of what drew me back to Nepal, really, for a second time.
And yeah, so that was going to be my next question, actually. So what sort of experiences or what sort of impact you had of the Sherpa people? And
yeah, so they're honestly the most amazing people I've ever met. They're just really lovely, very, very resilient people who have lived in that area for, well, hundreds of years, you know. And obviously in the last few years with the commercialization of Everest and kind of the amount of money that's come in because of Everest, I think the area's changed quite a lot. So listening to one of our Sherpa talk about when he was born, so he was in his 50s, so we're talking like 50 years ago. He was born in like a yak herding shed, essentially, on the side of a mountain, to his mother, who was actually herding yak that day. And they used to kind of like farm, which was their main subsistence and still is their main subsistence farming. And they used to carry that to sell in Tibet. So they used to go through the valleys into Tibet, or they used to go down to Kathmandu, which is like 3 to 5 days walk in either direction for them, to sell for other produce or to sell for items of wear or whatever, and then bring it back. And they used to do that all year round. And that was kind of all they did, you know, until kind of mountaineering started getting really big. That was kind of what they were renowned for. So yeah, like they're incredibly resilient people, and I think that still kind of shows now. Even the young guys, they're all very, very kind of rarely complaining, and really, really always eager to please. And they're just very humble people who just, yeah, want to talk to you and understand you. And likewise, I wanted to understand their culture as well, which is, yeah, really cool. And I was lucky enough to work with maybe 40 of these guys, kind of as cooks, as climbing Sherpas, guides, Sardars, porters. And yeah, they're just really lovely people to work with. And obviously, because of where they live, I was in a very fortunate position to kind of understand medical things, and they don't see doctors or anything. And there are some hospitals in the area now, but they're not really accessible for them. So yeah, it was really cool to just like actually just get involved with what's been going on in their lives and try and help them out a little bit. So that was, yeah, really humbling for me as well.
Did you find that they, as you were sort of talking to them and you were sort of checking up, or maybe when you're at base camp, did they approach you for advice medically, or did they, and what kind of, I imagine that cost is a bit of a restrictive thing for them, that they might not be able to afford to go to a hospital to go and see a doctor. And did you have any of those restrictions like placed on you? Were you sort of told, oh no, you can't use our medical supplies to treat the porters or anything like that?
No, 100% of my job was to look after not just the clients on our team, so the 10 climbers and the 60 clients we had in the valleys, but it was also to look after the Sherpa and our staff, because essentially that's what they are. We were all employees, and my job was to look after my colleagues, essentially. So yeah, that was, like I say, it was really rewarding for me. And like you say, they don't have much access to healthcare, and there is no doctor in the valley who looks after them all, and they do rarely go Kathmandu, I think, for when things are pretty bad, but it's mainly just operations or kind of cancers and things like that. The big stuff that's like quite obvious, whereas little niggly things they kind of just get by with, really. So that was really, really, really a big benefit to my job, really. And again, was one of the key elements of why I took it, really, because I was really excited to kind of work with these guys and understand their culture and also give something back to them, because again, they weren't just carrying the stuff for the guys on the mountain, they were carrying my stuff up the path as well. And you know, watching a person walk past you who looks about 50 kilograms carrying a 60 kilogram load is, yeah, pretty staggering.
Yeah, wow, that is an enormous weight. And yeah. Like I think you say later on in your essay, but that, you know, nobody would get up the mountain without the Sherpas, so
no, definitely, there would be no, I'm 100% certain of that.
So you said it's the Buddhist within the sort of Sherpa community. Did you have any experiences of like their kind of ceremonies or their customs as Buddhists? Were they practicing Buddhists, and what did that look like on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, so I think the most key element about that was Everest is called Choma Lungma in Tibetan, which is goddess of the sky. And essentially, yeah, it's quite a good name. And essentially, they're basically in a religion forbidden from climbing and stepping on her, essentially. So one of the key ceremonies that they perform, that all the teams, there's about 40 teams at base camp, and each team will perform a ceremony called a puja. And it's essentially asking for forgiveness to stand on Choma Lungma, so to stand on Everest itself. So we actually did two of these, and they asked about 3 or 4 hours, and essentially a lama comes and there's a lot of chanting that everyone kind of gets involved with, a lot of blessings given, and they kind of just make music, and they throw rice onto the chortan, which is this kind of, if you imagine a block kind of concrete box, they made out of stone, and then they raise a like almost like a flagpole on it, and then they stretch prayer flags from it, and that's essentially the chortan, which is what's left behind after the puja, to kind of, yeah, just to show that they've done the ceremony, to say this is our forgiveness. And they'll burn juniper bushes, and there'll be smoke and incense and all that kind of stuff, and that's all kind of part of the process of asking for forgiveness for them. And then when every time they went up the mountain, they would go and they would say a prayer beside the chortan, and then walk to the left of it before going up towards the icefall. So that was, so it was quite evident, like, and it was present in every single camp, which is, yeah, cool, to kind of witness, and also to be part of that kind of that ceremony was, yeah, really, really, really cool experience.
Yeah, and it's such a contrast, like the amount of respect that they have for the mountain versus a lot of the maybe Westerners or sort of other cultures who come to the mountain who maybe don't really share those values, or don't share the same respect for the mountain or climbing. And yeah, there's a bit of a clash there, I guess, sometimes. Does that sort of come across when you're in the community of base camp? Is that evident that there are some sort of differences in opinion there? Or
so I think the Buddhist side of it is, it's obviously very spiritual, and I'd say as Western, I put it in inverted commas, is a Western culture maybe doesn't, like, not many Western cultures are Buddhist themselves. So most of Buddhism is in East Asia, kind of that region towards Myanmar and Laos and stuff. So I guess it's hard for us to compare the spiritual nature of a mountain. There's no mountains in the UK that we find spiritual or anything. In fact, I can't even name any in Europe that are spiritual. But I guess, again, the significance for them is that, like, each village will have a mountain behind the village that is a spiritual mountain. And there's mountains in that valley that have never been climbed because of that reason. So Everest is kind of an anomaly in that sense, in that people are allowed to climb it because it's the highest mountain in the world. And they've made it into their religion that, okay, well, let's make forgiveness for this thing to go and do it. But there's other mountains that are completely, they're just not, they've never been climbed, because that's it. That's the rule. So yeah, so that's, again, I guess we, I'm not a spiritual person, I'm not religious, so I guess it's hard for us to sometimes appreciate that, perhaps, and maybe some people do get frustrated that they can't do those things. But again, I wouldn't begrudge them that for Everest. And even in their kind of their demeanor, they would kind of sense that there's something wrong, and And I wasn't there when this happened, but there's been past times when they've refused to go on a certain day because, I don't know, because the spirits aren't telling them not to, or the stars aren't aligned, or whatever it is. Like, they feel that as well. And I mean, sometimes they've been right. There's been earthquakes and avalanches and things. So,
I guess
we find it hard to appreciate that when you're not spiritual yourself.
No, I kind of almost wish I was, that I kind of had that connection, that I was so in tune with things that I kind of knew what was the mood of the mountain that day. But that's something that's kind of missing from more.
I think what's really special about Buddhism itself, and I've got friends who are Sri Lankan who are Buddhist, and it's just a philosophy of, like, kind of the giving and not receiving. That's the kind of the big thing that's really stood me with my friend who's from Sri Lanka, and just like, he gives money back to communities where he's from, and that's a portion of his wage, and he doesn't even think twice about that. You know, that's just like something you have to do as part of that religion, and it's something that he spiritually feels really, like, kind of in tune with. So I think we could do with more of that in our culture.
There's definitely a lot we could learn from it, isn't there?
Yeah, 100%.
And then you write about the enormous amount of logistics that was required in order to support climbers up Everest. And a lot of that is obviously reliant on the Sherpas and the porters, isn't it? You mentioned they were carrying enormous weights, you know, up the mountain. What's the sort of arrangements or standard of care or for the welfare of the porters
who are
supporting the climbers up the trip?
So in essence, the Sherpa people as a community essentially what run the Everest region. So they occupy all these jobs. So a porter is still a Sherpa person, most likely, but they're just not a climbing Sherpa. So a climbing Sherpa is someone who is on the mountain and carrying gear on the mountain and going up and down Everest and Amitabha and all these mountains and things. And then porters are kind of where everyone started at. So most of the Sherpa who climb used to be porters when they were kids. So I guess in terms of welfare, there is a hierarchical kind of almost increase and rise in your career as you get older. I mean, it doesn't happen for everyone. There's still people who are in their 50s who are porters. And the reason for that, I'm not sure. But the welfare for the Sherpas, I think, who are climbing and a part of the big companies, I think is quite good. So their wage that they can make in a year farming, they can make perhaps double, sometimes triple that in just one season. So in 3 to 4 months working for a company, doing the work they're doing on Everest. So be that putting up tents and setting up camps, or kind of climbing Everest and taking clients up or carrying gear up. And they get different companies paying different ways, but essentially you can get paid for doing a load, or you can get paid for summiting, or you can get paid for your performance. And some of them even get a gear allowance as well, so to buy new boots and new bags and things like that. So, and they live in tents and their food's paid for and things like that. So I think the welfare of the climbing Sherpa and the people who are working with the operators at base camp and in the valley is actually quite good from my experience, from what I saw from the company I work for, and what seemed to be happening for the other companies around. And the porters again do a very hard job. They're sometimes walking, I don't know, 20 to 30 km a day, carrying weights that I can't even imagine. Anywhere from, well, as an example, there was an example of 100 kilogram weight of an oven being taken up to base camp. So that's the kind of, anywhere from 10 kilos to 100 kilos is what you can be expected to carry. And obviously your pay is different rates based on the weight you're carrying and the distance you're going. And whether that's fair or not, I mean, the wage again is still, for their income, is still good. But obviously it's very hard labor. And the other issue for the porters is about their living conditions. So a lot of them live on the trail, but they live in kind of bunk houses with other porters, which have been set up for that purpose. But sometimes they're full. So say someone comes to base camp and they've brought a load and it's in the evening, they might have to walk down the valley again for 8 to 10 km to go and find a place to stay, to then come back in the morning to do the same job. So again, I think that is one of the issues with the porters, really, is that in terms of them not being mistreated, but like in terms of facilities for them, they're certainly lacking in that sense.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. You give a really good sort of picture of that. Obviously they are sort of essential to getting 100%. All the gear up to base camp, to setting 100%. Up the camps, to yeah. you know, fixing ropes and stuff up Everest, and all of the sort of basics that support a climber to actually get to the top of Everest.
I mean, if you think about it, I think I did the math when I was there. It's for every one climber you get up Everest, so one client, I think it takes between 6 and 8 like Sherpa people, or 6 to 8 people in a team to get that person to the top. So if you've got a team of 10, that's 8 people to get someone to the summit, you know. So,
yeah, it's massive. Yeah, and like we said before, you know, you say in your essay, where would we be without the Sherpa?
Still at the bottom of the mountain.
Yeah, at the base of the mountain.
Definitely, yeah. That's 100% true. But that's been true for years. You know, if you read like Tenzing's kind of autobiography, if you read Pete Boardman's kind of trip up the North Face, like, without the Sherpa, they are undoubted and they're respected for being the best at what they do, which is working at high altitude and carrying ridiculous loads. That is they're renowned for it, and that's rightly so. They're the kings of that.
Did you say that mostly they are like people who live at altitude? Are they already acclimatized, or do you get people from sort of lowland areas coming to do the job?
I mean, so I'm not sure about the genetics of their people, but I'm pretty sure there are papers looking into the genetics of the Sherpa and whether they are kind of genetically better. I think it came out that there was. One of the examples, one of the guides for our team was living in America, and he came across to do the trip. And he's Nepali, he's a Sherpa, he's summited Everest now 22 times, and I honestly don't think he batted an eyelid. So I think, regardless of whether they live at low level or not, I think they are acclimatized in some way to the altitude. And the speed that they walk at 5,000 meters is, yeah, what you'd expect us to walk at jogging a race against Killian Jornet, you know? That's,
wow. Yeah, they're overtaking you. Like,
Even the porters with their weights, their loads will overtake you. Like, they are rapid.
Did you see any particular like medical problems with the Sherpas or with the porters? Sort of, I'm guessing, kind of MSK pain, maybe back pain or blisters, or any of that sort of stuff.
MSK pain with them was, quite frequent, but mainly, and I think the biggest in the area at the moment, and certainly this year, was cough. And yeah, just the prevalent cough and the differentials regarding cough are really, really tricky to deal with at altitude. So there's obviously, well, I can come on to it a little bit later, but there's obviously high altitude cough.
I think it's interesting. Yeah, to hear about it.
There's high altitude cough, which is kind of called, in the region, it's called Kumbu cough, which is like a hoarseness, dry throat, kind of post nasal drip kind of thing. You've obviously got viral cough, and there were multiple cases of COVID at base camp this year. And whether that's COVID or we had some Sherpas, so we had some bacterial throats as well. So all those three things are very difficult to interpret for one, to get on top of for two, and then to make a decision about for three, because my kind of approach was to start with the simple things like strepsils and paracetamol, unless they had like a glaringly obvious pussy back of their throat with like lymph nodes or anything, and then to move on to, okay, is this viral? So how long is it going to be prolonged for? Is anyone else getting it in the group? And then still just supportive management. And then, are they spiking fevers? Are they getting worse? Okay, it's bacterial, give them some antibiotics. Because I didn't want to just blank. If I start with antibiotics, everyone but except me had a cough. So they all be on antibiotics for their throat, which I don't think is that appropriate. So yeah, it was really tricky to differentiate between those three things. And the other thing I discovered when I was kind of up there was this thing called laryngitis sicca, which I'd never heard of until I Googled it. And essentially, my boss, Cotter, he told me of this case that he'd had multiple years ago. He's like 40 years experience in the mountains and things. And a doctor had said that this guy was like sloughing from his throat. He had like cornflakes coming up, almost like it was just disintegrating. And he went home and had a scope, and they just saw that his larynx was like falling apart, basically. And then it was called laryngitis sicca. And we had a case of a guy who, again, he would just like, he was coughing up cornflakes. And I was like, oh, is this laryngitis sicca? And I looked it up, and I don't have a scope, so I couldn't see into his throat. But it turns out he had strep A in his throat.
I'm going to have to go away and look that one up. That sounds interesting.
Yeah. I've actually tried to get in touch with someone who did a paper on it, but they haven't replied. So I'm still waiting to hear.
Oh, I'd have been like, hey, get over here. Have a look at this throat. What do you think? Is it laryngitis? Have a look at it.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Cool. Yeah, so lots of different differentials for cough on a mountain, some of which are serious. And I guess you can't isolate everybody with like a cough that sounds, could be viral, but also could be just cough or whatever.
I mean, I think we all know that in mountain medicine, prevention is key. And so we just like, you know, hand washing, cleanliness, using a mask if you had a bad cough, and yeah, just doing the basic things really and trying to stop the spread. But yeah, that was basically it.
Cool. Well, that brings us nicely onto sort of like the medicine bits on the mountain that you did. So what was your role as the doctor at Everest Base Camp for your team?
So I trekked in with the climbing group who were doing Everest and also a trekking team. So there was probably about 30 of us on the trek going up, maybe 25. And then I then stayed at base camp for a month and 20 days, basically, while the climbers did their rotations onto the mountain and summited. And then during that time, there were also multiple groups in the lower valleys doing Island Peak, Mirror Peak, other mountains in the area, and some of them visited base camp. And basically I was kind of doing telemedicine for those teams as well, so interacting with their guides, their Sherpa, and seeing them when they arrived if there were any problems. And then I walked out with the climbing team then at the very end, so we were the last people left, and we left together.
That sounds busy.
So I made almost 300 consultations over a 2-month period, and I diagnosed 148 diagnoses in a list. So yeah, so it was fairly busy, like, but it was really interesting stuff, and there weren't many things that were that worrying. Like, most of it was, like I say, it's like cough differentials, MSK stuff, a lot of gastroenteritis, as we know from our research in terms of people being away, but yeah, some interesting cases as well. Definitely some interesting cases.
So maybe talk us through what your typical day would look like. What was your sort of routine?
Yeah, so it was very cold, so I'd probably get up about 5, and it was still dark, with ice around my sleeping bag, and then go and sit by the gas fire and just read my book for an hour. Then I go outside when the sun rose, so the sun would just come up every day, same place, straight off the tent. It was beautiful. Beautiful sunrise. And then I'd probably start checking in with the teams down the valley. So we had Wi-Fi up there, so on WhatsApp, just kept checking in with any complaints or issues that had happened overnight, or just any issues that had happened kind of last few days that I wanted to just make sure we were going okay. And then our team would get up about 8, we'd all have breakfast together. I tried not to do the daily how's everyone feeling thing. I just wanted them to kind of have their own space as well. And then we were all quite pally, so they knew I was there if they needed any problems, and that worked quite well, I think. So when they were there, we just have breakfast, and then might go on a day hike, so kind of up there, so we go towards that, or Kalapatar. You can go back down towards Gorak Shep and go up Kalapatar. So they're all kind of like 2 to 4 hour hikes, depending on how fast and how slow you want to go, how much you want to carry. So that was good for them for training when we were off the mountain, and then good for me to just keep a little bit fit, because bacon and eggs every morning doesn't really help. And then we just kind of chill out if they were there, read some books, play some games, and then go to bed about kind of 7 or 8 after dinner. And then same again the next day. If they were on the mountain, it was a bit different. So we kind of, it was radio comms or sat phone comms. So we would kind of check in when they were, we'd find out the day before when they were going to move. So if they were going from like camp 2 to camp 3, say at like leave at 5 o'clock, we'd get up at 4, check in with them as they're getting ready, make sure everything's okay, and then let them carry on, and then maybe go back to bed for an hour or two, and then get back up to check in with them again when they were kind of like getting towards the camp or whatever. So yeah, often take a radio to bed, just in case there's any problems or anything. And then the only different change was really summit night, because obviously they start so early. So we were up till they left camp 4, but then they go behind, so we can't really hear from them when they're behind, from the side that we can view, essentially, because there's no radio comms. So we then went to bed and then got up again when we were expecting them to come up onto the south summit, and then we got in touch with them again then, and then just ran through the whole of their day basically when they were summiting.
So did you have to adapt, I guess, the questions you were asking or the things that you were checking in with the teams because of the radio comms, you know, or was it fairly good comms? Could you have a proper conversation, or was it quite broken and did you kind of just have to keep it short and sweet?
Yeah, at times it was very difficult. I think the most difficult interactions with the communication was so not all times our team was on the mountain. There'd be Sherpa from our team on the mountain, like obviously going up, taking loads and and getting camp sorted and taking food and things. I think the most difficult thing about communication on a radio is when you don't speak the same language as the other person. So
yeah.
I was translating to my Sirdar, who was translating onto the radio to the person who was speaking to him, who was then asking the person next to him what the problem was. So it was like a four-person thing. And I would not only get diluted information, it was just sometimes like completely out there.
Yeah.
So for example, there was one guy who had, well, eventually he had pneumonia basically, but on the mountain, it sounded like hape. So I was like, oh, he needs some like nephelope when he's getting some oxygen, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, the next thing I knew was he'd taken his oxygen off and run away, like on the mountain. And it was like dark. And I was like, what do you mean he's run away? Like, anyway, so I, like, they got him back.
He's not going anywhere very quickly at that altitude.
Exactly. They got him back anyway, and then like sat him down, like sorted him out. He came down the next day and I saw him. I was like, so what happened when you ran away? And he was like, oh, no, I felt really claustrophobic with the mask on. So I just got up and moved outside the tent so I could get some fresh air. And I was
complete miscommunication there.
So you know, it's just funny stuff like that happens. And often the radios were like battery problems because it was cold or like really, really poor signal. We tried to do an evacuation on the radio, and it was really, really difficult just because the communication was really bad. And I was trying to talk to the insurance company and they were trying to talk to me. And yeah, so it can be tricky and it's certainly not ideal, but you make do, you know.
Did you, I guess maybe as you were there a little bit longer and maybe there'd been a few runs up and down the mountain, did you like get the chance to kind of speak to your Sherpas and say, look, if I say nifedipine, yeah, this is what I mean, sort of thing, and give them a little pre-briefing? Or
yeah, I mean, we had medical kits that I sent up onto the mountain and I ran them through them with that, and they were quite clearly labeled with AMS and gastro and that kind of stuff, but again, they're not, this in no way meant to be rude or anything, but they're not used to dealing with medicines, you know. It wouldn't need this kind of average Joe blogs on the street, you know. So I think from there, culturally for them, even taking medicine is like a big step, let alone working out which one it is or what to take and why. And I think they're not obstructive or perhaps reluctant to do so, you know. There's a lot of coming what they're very humble people, you know. They also don't like to complain and they don't like to take medicines, and that's just part of their culture. And that's, I knew that was something I wasn't going to change, and I'm not trying to reinvent the wheel, but it was kind of that discussion between us was always fairly tricky. Oh, do you want some help? Or no, it's fine. Like, I often ask the Sherpa who looked unwell, do you want some help? Do you want a hand? Oh, no, it's fine. Like, don't worry.
And they're
very used to basic things, you know, like, oh, I've got an ankle injury, so paracetamol, ibuprofen. Get me some ibuprofen spray or some ibuprofen gel. That's all they want. They don't want anything higher than that because they're not used to it, which is understandable, you know. So, yeah, so it's kind of, I didn't want to overload them with that kind of stuff. I just wanted to give them things they were used to because and they're more likely to take it and engage.
Yeah, definitely. So we've already touched on like some of the difficulties of communication that you had maybe whilst your team was up the mountain. What were some of the other challenges that you experienced?
I can't really compare it to any other years because obviously never been there before. But I think one is just the volume for people. So obviously I made almost 300 consultations, which over that time wasn't many. But you're obviously just, you're there on your own. There is no backup. You're very isolated. And the decisions I'm making were basically like, I had to be comfortable with them and kind of put it to the side and be like, well, that's the decision I made. So like move on and see if it works. And I guess the flip side of that is that, so in the whole of base camp, there were seven doctors. So there's 3,000 people there and there's seven doctors. Four people work for companies, three for HRAs. The HRA is the Himalayan Rescue Association. And they run an Everest ER up there. So like a big tent that you pay, I think it's about $150. You can pay them and basically you can go and use their services whenever you want. And I mean, I think they would have been overrun by coughs and colds. And again, even it would have been even harder for them to differentiate between what was what. And I think that's kind of the biggest stress and challenge for a doctor up there is just, I think it's just knowing where your threshold is and being like, well, this is it. You're gone. Like, I'm done now. Like, this is all I can do. We've tried. Or like, this is all I can do. That's the end. Off you go. So, and I think that's a really, we did send two people home. Both of them weren't on a medical basis. But even some of those interactions were really to do. And it was just very tough to
Yeah, they're high stakes interactions, aren't they? When people have put so much effort and time and sometimes money into being there that they really don't want to go home. And
I think that's the key thing is they're very reluctant to leave because they've paid so much, and you're trying to advise them from the best, from your experience and what you know, and it's always hard.
Was there much conferring with the other doctors there for a bit of kind of?
We had a WhatsApp group, and we did share resources. So we like asked about skids and gamma bags up the mountain, and we had one, so we sent one, and then well, the guys kept those back. But we were very much an individual kind of. We worked on our own. Mm-hmm. I think the reason for that is because you're at risk of then overwhelming yourself. So I was very pally with the next company next door. A couple of them were Scottish. We got on pretty well. And the companies themselves have been working together for many, many years. So I kind of helped them out a little bit. I saw a couple of their clients, and I was actually involved in a death of theirs, which was very unfortunate. And I think that worked well. But I think any more than that, and I would have been overwhelmed just being on my own. And, you know, I only had a certain amount of resources in my box anyway, and that was kind of getting used up for my people. So, yeah, so it's tricky. It was tricky to, yeah. You wanted to help, but you didn't want to do too much. Yeah.
Okay, so
I guess the other thing to say about that before you go on is just as well the limitations of what you can do, and actually if someone's made a decision and they're comfortable with that, I think you kind of just have to accept that, and almost too many cooks kind of will probably spoil the broth, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, and you don't want to sort of second guess somebody. And so what were some of the kind of common stuff that you mentioned? Coughs, colds, gastroenteritis, any other sort of run-of-the-mill day-to-day things that you were seeing? Or
Headaches, so high altitude headaches, tension headaches, dehydration headaches, yeah, they were all fairly common. Obviously doesn't really matter if it's due to AMS or due to kind of dehydration. Treatment's basically the same, isn't it? Paracetamol, get some fluids in you. There was what else was there? Gastro, already said, a bit of constipation, some of the acute mountain, the high altitude stuff, sunburn, that kind of stuff, all the kind of basic GP stuff, I guess you'd see on a day-to-day basis, like with, is this bad enough to have something, or is this just something that I can get on with? And obviously being at altitude is a bit different. But yeah, that was kind of the common themes, really.
And what about some of the kind of interesting cases that you mentioned, things that that'll stick with you?
So one was, kind of the throat stuff was interesting because I'm like, just from a learning point of like, oh, would I have done anything different? I'm not really sure. I took three of them to hospital when we got back to Kathmandu just to get chest x-rays and stuff, because I was still just like, oh, is this still something, or is this just a cough that's lasting ages? And thankfully they were all just coughs that were lasting ages, and the doctor was happy, all the bloods were normal and stuff. So that's great. There was one case of C. diff when someone got home. So that was a really odd one. So she only had gastro for 3 days at the end of the trip, and I hadn't treated her with antibiotics for anything. She had a throat problem. I didn't treat her for anything, and then she went home and did a stool sample. She was positive for C. diff. So that was something I've never heard of, never seen before. She hadn't been admitted to hospital recently. I've not seen any case studies of C. diff being present in a person on an expedition. So that was pretty interesting. So a couple of frostbite cases. So two of our Sherpa unfortunately got frostbite, one in the foot, one in the hand, and they're very keen to chop everything off out there. So it's almost like you get there and chop it off. But thankfully we got them reviewed at a different hospital, and they've been bandaging them now since mid-May, and they've kept all their fingers and toes. So that's something I've not really come across really before. I don't really know what the dressings are. It's something I need to look into. But that was a positive outcome from something that could have been quite bad. And then the two other really interesting ones, one was a Hayes case. So a guy who's 36 he was having a headache in the night at 4,200 meters. Headache in the night, resolved in the morning, and then blurred vision. Hmm. And then that would resolve in the middle of the day. And then the next day, he had headache in the night again, woke up with blurred vision, and then it resolved. And I basically said, if they were staying at the same altitude, I was like, well, this could be something nasty, so let's just keep you there for a day. So he had another headache that night, woke up with blurred vision, and I asked him to go to the clinic, he was in a town with a clinic, thankfully, and they looked in his eyes, and they could see that his optic disc was kind of
All blurry and fuzzy.
Yeah, you know, when there's some increased intracranial pressure, so he's like cupping. And so I already said that if there's any problem with the examination, we should evacuate this man. And we evacuated him. He had an MRI in Kathmandu, and it showed he had HACE. But he had right-sided sixth nerve palsy, and that was the only sign. Because he every time he looked left, right, he had double vision, and with his blurred vision. It was bizarre.
It wasn't something to do with, like, when he was lying down, his intracranial pressure would go up, and then when he stood up, it would get better?
No idea. I've looked again to see if there's been any like isolated nerve palsies in the eye regarding HACE, and there's none. So that was
he wasn't like ataxic, confused, nothing like that. Just wow.
Yeah. And so he's home now. He's back in Australia, and he's had repeat MRIs, and it's all resolved. So yeah, so it was definitely HACE. But that was an interesting. It was kind of the back of my mind. I was like, is this HACE? But it sounds very atypical. And then it turns out it was. So that was cool. And then there was. One chap, again, just to show the resilience of a Sherpa, this guy had acute cholecystitis, basically. Abdo pain, like guarding on the right up quadrant. He had some poor appetite, had vomited a couple of times. And I was like, oh, this is acute cholecystitis. And I was like, you need to go and, well, here's some antibiotics for one, and we need to get you out of here. And he was like, no, I'll stay and see if the antibiotics work. And I was like, okay, but you know, like there's a significant risk this could like get worse and blah, 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 and went all that spiel. And thankfully it got better. So within 3 days, he was much, much better. No more guarding in his tummy, nothing like that. And then it kind of got a little bit worse the day before he was going to summit. So the day before they would go on their summit rotation and he was still in the antibiotics. And I said, are you sure you want to do this? I again would recommend you go home, like we get you down to Kathmandu and evacuate you. And he said, no, I'd like to go. So he summited Everest as a Sherpa carrying almost 12 kilos of oxygen bottles. And he vomited blood on the summit and he had steatorrhea on the trip up, and he came down and he went to hospital and he had multiple stones in his gallbladder. So that just shows how resilient these guys are, you know?
So tough.
Yeah, exactly. So that was quite remarkable.
Yeah, but really. I guess a real challenge medically, because
you
must have they either, like you said, don't kind of want your help. They're kind of like, oh, I'm just going to tough it out, or I'm just going to take the bare minimum sort of thing. Or they're just not going to tell you about it, and they're just going to kind of cover up how bad things are and kind of.
I think as well, they get a summit bonus and that play. I think that plays a big part in their life. You know, the money is important to them. Naturally, they know they can make a lot of money if they do a good job. And this guy was a tough cookie. You know, seasoned veteran of Everest, I think it was his 13th time up or something. So
oh wow, yeah. And I guess if you've summited once, then you're probably more likely to be taken on as a climbing Sherpa again. And
I think this guy had worked for the company for years, so
let that be a lesson to how tough Sherpas are, definitely.
Yeah.
So sadly, we're going to have to leave it there for this episode, but tune in to the next episode to hear more about Ben's experiences and involvement with some of the deaths on Everest this year, some of the politics on the mountain, including the incredible amount of litter that there is, and who's responsible for this problem, how to solve this problem, and one of the other issues on Everest this year, which was theft, including theft of oxygen cylinders. We'll also be talking a little bit about some of the attitudes of paying clients on the mountain and how this can be a challenge for the medic as well. So tune into the next episode to hear more from Ben about his experiences as a base camp doctor for a team climbing Everest in 2023, the season of death.
Thanks for listening to the episode. Please feel free to rate, review and subscribe on whichever platform you're listening to. Please also head over to the World Extreme Medicine website, where you can find more engaging content on extreme medicine webinars and indeed the collection of courses from our global network, including humanitarian, disaster relief, expedition, space, military, tactical and performance medicine. Thanks again.